So, Stacy Craig, who many of you know, and probably as an amazing person, is giving our message today on Black Theology of Liberation. For those of you who aren't familiar with Stacy, she currently works as the coordinator of applied learning at Northland College. And she is also currently at the United Theological Seminary in the Twin Cities pursuing her Master's of Divinity. And in the last year, Stacy has been interning with St. John's United Church of Christ and the Spiritual Life Center on Madeline Island. But before that, she was very active here at UU. She still is. but was the co-director of religious education. So we're very happy to have you here today, Stacy, and looking forward to your message.
Spontaneous solos. Hands in the air, hips swaying, every child perfectly in rhythm, the hand clapping and foot stomping at the same time, which is something I could not do. When we're young, we think we know the world. Our world represents the world. A school is a school. Granola and yogurt is breakfast. But when I was in Jamaica, I learned that what I knew of church did not define church. Midwestern American Protestantism did not prepare me for the shower of love and comfort, joy and affirmation that I experienced in my body, that I was worthy of love even though I couldn't clap in time. I remember that even though it was the summer after 9/11 and I was living in a suburb of Kingston for 6 weeks where the Jamaican government had cut off our water supply, that on Sunday mornings, we were refreshed, and everything was going to be all right. I am honored to have received an invitation to speak here today in tribute to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In seminary, I've been studying liberation theology, including Black theology, which emerged in the 1960s after King's death. But I start today in Jamaica, because it was there where I learned what it means when people say that the Black church was born fighting for freedom. For both personal salvation and social justice and equality in our societies. If we assume that the Black church tradition is what was fed to enslaved Africans by men who called themselves masters, then we neglect to hear the uniqueness of their tradition. Of things such as the African cosmology, where spirit, earth, and humanity are interconnected. Many of us are familiar with the doctrine of discovery, where king and priest came together to lands, to these lands, to say that theologically and politically, our race is the chosen race, and we may enslave and convert and kill in Jesus Christ's name, in this land. I accepted the invitation to speak today not because a white, middle-class, Midwestern woman raised in the Protestant Christian tradition can speak on behalf of the Black church or the African-American experience, but because I can speak to this theology brought by my European ancestors and say they were wrong. It's bad interpretation. It's exploitive to both the history of the Christian Judaic tradition and humanity. And it's just not the truth. In seminary, we talk about Christianities, not Christianity, because there are so many different threads and interpretations. And there's one thread that we hear in Martin Luther King Jr., similar to what I experienced in Jamaica, and have studied liberation, and it is the thread of freedom and liberation. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was brought up in the Black church and he was a pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. The current pastor there, Raphael Warnock, writes that the freedom for which the black church has fought has always been both internal and external, expressing itself politically and spiritually, embracing black bodies and souls. This is so because historically the faith of the black church has been shaped by two complementary yet competing sensibilities, revivalist piety and radical protest. Revivalist piety. This is the individual, the image of the hands in the air, hips swaying, direct communion with the spirit. It is knowing that you are loved and worthy of love. Radical protest. It is the social, human dignity for all, such as what is expressed in the Bill of Rights. The example which some may be familiar with or may recall is Reverend Jeremiah Wright. During Barack Obama's campaign, sound clips began to circulate where Wright, the pastor who had married the Obamas and baptized both of his children, was quoted pounding, shouting on the pulpit, "God damn America." Do you remember this? I do. I was somewhere between amen and can you do that in church? What is this? And for many, that might have been their first exposure to the black church of America. The clips included him saying, "The government gives them drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three strikes law, and then wants us to sing God bless America? No, 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 God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people." In an ABC interview about this message, one congregation member was quoted saying, "I wouldn't call it radical. I call it being black in America." Historically, though, the focus has been of the black church has been on the internal spiritual life and the individual convergence experience. So what made Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. different? Why did he bring his work as a pastor to the public square? Warnock proposes that Martin Luther King Jr. was one of the first to reconcile these two parts of the black church experience and history. He believes this is because King's conversion experience was when he received a particularly disturbing death threat after he had become involved in the civil rights movement. And he was sitting at his kitchen table and he heard a voice, the voice of God, he said, assuring him that God was with him in the battle for social justice. So Warnock believes that King was different because he equally linked his personal encounter with God with being a public voice for justice. The first principle of Unitarian Universalism that we just recited today is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And it is human dignity that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. addresses again and again in the reason for his faith and action to meet as one. Coretta Scott King writes of her husband that the central element of his philosophy on nonviolence was his belief in a divine, loving presence that binds all life. King studied at Boston University, where theologians were working with a system of thought known as personalism. Rooted in German idealism, essentially this states that the self is at the center of conscious experience and is the most fundamental reality there is. For King, there is a personal God which we can know and who knows us. And that's the most fundamental reality there is. Thus, there is infinite value in the individual. Evil, then, is that which degrades the individual, and racism violates the dignity of human people, of the person. Thus, King's emphasis on human dignity is the ultimate principle, the spiritual underpinning upon which everything else is based in his work. And I believe that this is why many who have studied King say that America's original sin is racism. The theological, as personal, as political, is evident in his definition and work with the Beloved community. From the King Center, they describe the Beloved community as a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth. In the Beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood. Thus, we see King's emphasis on integration and nonviolence was key to achieving this vision. King knew he was proposing democratic socialism as an alternative to capitalism. He reached across aisles and sat with men who hated him, who threatened him. To not put himself in power over others, but to work towards sisterhood and brotherhood. And each year we remember Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the third Monday of January because he stood for this dignity for all. He endured violence with nonviolence. And like so many who challenged the dominant culture, he was silenced. So what happened next? Did the black church or the white church or the academy or any of those who banded together in the civil rights movement take up his belief and see the Beloved community through? For many, something died when King was assassinated. Professor and theologian James Cone reflected that the King assassination was a turning point in my life. As long as King was alive, I had hope that white America could be converted to seeing Negroes as human beings. Without King, where was the hope? Malcolm X repeatedly told King and the Negro masses that white America had no conscience and would never treat blacks as human beings unless we forced them to. Malcolm's words were ringing true for me. Cone began to write, to find his voice, and became the father of black theology. It's interesting to note that at this exact same time in the world, Gustavo Gutierrez was developing liberation theology along these exact same lines in South America, and these two people never communicated with each other. They both published books and worked on these things in parallel at the same time. But for Cone, black theology was situated in America, and it reflects his attempt to reconcile Martin's strategies for nonviolence and messages of hope with Malcolm's insistence by any means necessary. The dream that could be with the nightmare of what was for life, especially in northern ghettos. Code's urgency and forcefulness is clear when we must resist how oppression and racism threatens being and human dignity, which we read in his first book, Black Theology and Black Power, which was published in 1969, where he states, "Black power is a humanizing force because it is the black man's attempt to affirm his being. His powerful interpretation that Christian theology affirms God is with the oppressed and against the oppressor leads him to conclude, all ideas which are opposed to the struggle for black self-determination or are irrelevant to it must be rejected as the work of the Antichrist." If this is the first time you're hearing about James Cone, do you now understand why? I think he is saying that if you aren't working to end racism in America or doing anything related to it, you're going to hell. Essentially, my history classes demonized Malcolm X and black power as angry, violent, and hateful to all white people. Similarly, Cone's black theology makes people uncomfortable because they believed by any means necessary evokes violence. Cone reflects that he wrote Black Theology and Black Power not to condone violence, not to use violence, but to address the racism in the white churches and the self-loathing in the black churches. He was trying to confront what he called the absurdity of being black in a crazy white world. He writes, "We all know about pearly gates, golden streets, and long white robes. We have sung songs about heaven until we are hoarse, but it did not change the present state or ease the pain. We want to know why Harlem cannot be Jerusalem, and Chicago the promised land. What good are golden crowns, slippers, white robes, or even eternal life if it means that we have to turn our backs to the pain and suffering of our own children?" Cohn interpreted the key theme of the Bible as liberation. He writes, "The central message of the Bible is God's liberation of the poor from oppression. That theme is found in the Exodus of ancient Israel from Egypt, the prophets' messages of justice, and most of all in Jesus' birth in a stable, his preaching of liberation and solidarity with the poor, and his death and resurrection. Liberation of the poor from the shackles of bondage is the central message of the Bible. His bottom line, God's revelation means liberation. Nothing more, nothing less. God, as inseparable from the suffering of the oppressed, leads him to conclude that there is no place in black theology for a colorless God where human beings suffer precisely because of their color. The black theologian must reject any conception of God which stifles black self-determination by picturing a God as a God of all peoples. Either God is identified with the oppressed to the point that their experience becomes God's experience, or God is a God of racism." Cohn invites all people to become black with God, to become with the one with the liberation of the oppressed, and this then, for him, is the meaning of salvation accessible to all. In Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel's final book, Open Heart, he writes, "At the time of the liberation of the camps, I remember we were convinced that after Auschwitz, there would be no more wars, no more racism, no more hatred, no more anti-Semitism. But we were wrong. And this produced a feeling close to despair. For if Auschwitz could not cure mankind of racism, was there any chance of success ever? About 3 years ago, I started seminary, and people often asked me why. I think it was the contradiction between belovedness and exploitation, between human dignity and oppression, that finally led me to seminary. At some point, the answers and thoughts that I had just didn't make sense in this world. I'm sort of obsessed with the question of what are the sources of evil and suffering, and how do we diminish them? How do we endure them?" Eco-womanist Melanie Harris proposes that when we look at the parallels of abuse on the body of the earth and the bodies of colored women, defilement happens when that which is alive becomes an object to be owned. And when using intersectional analysis, looking at the intersection of race, class, and gender, she concludes that the objectification and abuse happens in systems of capitalism and patriarchy, systems which perpetuate unequal power and privilege. When people ask me, "How central do you believe racism is to the work of the church? Shouldn't spiritual communities be about our inner lives or universal values? And don't we minimize our concerns by making them about a social issue, such as racism, or for that matter, climate change, or others?" I believe that racism is absolutely central to the mission and vocation of all religious and spiritual communities. I think it has to be. To work against racism is to affirm humanity for all. I realize that we don't talk a lot about Christian theology at our fellowship, but I think it is so important to engage with some of these concepts because the Bible is still the best-selling book in the world today. Or at least it was 2 years ago when I took New Testament. It's still a dominant force. And in some places, it's been misconstrued in ways that perpetuate this patriarchy and capitalism. When we hold the doctrine of discovery and the beloved community of Dr. King together, we can see the difference in how theology is lived in our lives, in our bodies, in our world, in our nation. Can you imagine what would happen if every church critically examined Black theology? If they took seriously Cone's call to become one and Black with God? I realize Cone is using the word God, but whether we believe in a God or not is not the point. Is part of our ultimate concern as a community the worth and dignity of all people? I believe that is one place where faith communities of the nation, of the world, could band together to again take up the call to the beloved community. And one way this starts is by seeing racism and inequality as spiritual issues. This matters, I think, because as long as it is just an issue, a social justice issue or a political issue, racism is someone else's issue to fix. If it is a spiritual issue, it is part of our shared humanity, and it is tied to our own wholeness. In Cone's memoir, Said I Wasn't Gonna Tell Nobody, Cone's final chapters conclude with reflections on the topic of suffering. He writes, to see beauty in tragedy is very difficult. One needs theological eyes to do that. We have to look beneath the surface and get to the source. Suffering is the bridge that connects all people. Death and suffering are the great equalizer. But he also writes that suffering separates people when they don't recognize one another as human beings. We understand suffering when we learn from people who have suffered and overcome. After over 40 years of teaching, mainly at Union Seminary in New York, and writing about Black theology, publishing over 10 books, and giving countless speeches and lectures, having brought defiance and resistance alongside nonviolence in the public expression of his faith, Cone concludes in his memoir, which he finished as he was dying last year, with this profound statement: I would rather be the one who suffered wrong than the one who did wrong. Alice Walker has a new book of poetry out, and in her poem for Martin Luther King Jr., titled The New Dark Ages, she writes, as we slip into the new dark ages, you become more dear to me. Your face, your smile, that carefully trimmed, never to turn gray hair. We may not emerge from this darkness in my lifetime, and yet I think of you, so often smiling or laughing outright, your sturdy frame gallant and ready for the fight. Walker's title is a bit haunting, The New Dark Ages. In an interview about this poem, she says that she means it literally, that we are just awakening to the fact that we are all being harmed. She ends the poem with that no matter how deep the fall into obscurity and obscenity this new age portends, life might permit us to remain standing, if only on the inside, smiling and laughing with you among the solemn army who went out into the darkness all those years ago, always singing to examine the path and be the light. One of the things James Cone told his students and readers again and again was find your voice. Cone did this when he connected to his experience of suffering, reflected on its meaning, and came forward and said, no more. This stops now. I don't think I would be giving this message or taking James Cone so seriously if I didn't know the long, slow arms of justice, which spin and spin, never arriving at some hour of justice. Our suffering can isolate us. It can make us bitter, insular, broken, or it can unite us. King could have given up when he received death threats to his life and family, and instead he became the light. In this new dark age, I think this is more important to recognize now than ever. If we make the dignity of all people, even those we don't like, even those we don't want to work with, at the center of our being, can we help America become black with God? Thank you.